Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses, and I do it for an audience of real entrepreneurs. Joining me today is a person who's followed my work here for a long time, and I'm excited to have him on here. But before I tell you about his business, I got to tell you about drinks that I had with my wife, and I got to tell you, David, I think you'll identify with this. My wife and I went out to one of the fancy cocktail places here in San Francisco where they actually will not let you tell them what you want. You tell them what you're into, they make you a specialty cocktail, you drink it. As soon as they put it in front of her, she made one of these, like she drank it and she made one of these faces. And immediately the guy saw that face and he realized, you know what, this is not for you, I can make you another drink. And he made her another drink. Now, and that she loved and we had a good evening. I think about that a lot when it comes to online businesses. I cannot tell when someone is wincing when they're looking at one of my websites. I cannot tell when I've turned somebody off completely, let alone turned off a lot of people, because I'm not looking over their shoulders, or better yet, I'm not looking behind their computer screens to see their faces as they're interacting with me. And the reason I'm bringing this up with you, David, is because what you did is you created a set of tools that allow websites to do that. To see where are their users clicking, where are they confused and backing away, to actually in some cases see heat maps, in other cases if they want it, even see click by click, scroll by scroll what's going on. And David's business allows you to also ask questions of your users so that you understand why they're doing what they're doing and what they like and don't like about your site. David is David Darmanin. He is the co-founder of Hotjar. They're an analytics and feedback tools company that allow you to see how your site is being used. We're going to find out how he went from a bunch of failures, actually a couple, let's not overstate it, to finally figuring out what the right product is and getting his mojo and building up his sales. And boy, they keep growing. This interview is sponsored by two great companies. It's called HostGator for hosting websites. And the second is for hiring developers. It's called TopTal. David, I was looking at you as I did that intro. First of all, it was kind of weird because I addressed you and then you did hi and then you realized, oh, it's not really me yet. And second, there was that period where I was describing the drink that I had with my wife and how it related to Hotjar. And I get the sense that maybe you weren't fully on board with that description.
No, I think it was spot on. I think we're in the business of allowing you to see the winces, right? So, but it's not that easy to do. But we live in a time where it's so easy to not even see that, right? We're sitting in this protected environment behind our screens looking at the graphs and the numbers. And it's so easy to dehumanize the experience. So yeah, spot on.
That is it. And how much revenue are you guys bringing in from that?
So our annual recurring revenue is, I was thinking to do it in dollars, but I think it's going to be easier in euros. So we're just over 15 million. So and growing quite well.
So 15 million euros, that's 17.4 million US dollars. I looked you guys up on Crunchbase. I looked you up on AngelList to see who funded this business. I don't see any investors.
Yeah, I don't like the term bootstrap because it typically means like poof, you like create something from nothing, and some people can do that, right? But we did self-fund. So there was a first round where we put in just over 100,000 euros. Then I was also consulting for 6 months, so I wasn't being paid a salary, consulting on the side and bringing all that revenue into the business.
Got it.
And that was around 200,000, and then we invested on our own another 200,000. So it's a considerable amount of funds to get this.
It just wasn't outside funds. It was your funds. And the reason you had it is you're a guy who did conversion rate work for a long time. In fact, you know what? Let me just go back a step. You're from Malta. You went to law school. You told our producer it was a bullshit career decision that I'm not proud of. And then you got into conversion rate optimization, which is what allowed you to fund this business. But why would you say to our producer you're not proud to be a lawyer? Why would you say it was a bullshit career decision?
Well, I'd say I played it safe, right? And back then, the options weren't many. But I think deep down, I knew that I wasn't going to get like the most out of that kind of choice. But having said that, I was lucky enough, and I give this advice to anyone who's gonna go like the academic route, is I did a lot of things on the side while I was doing it. So at least it wasn't
because
that bad.
Because you weren't loving it, because you're a guy who is an entrepreneur. The other thing that you happen to mention to our producer is, as a kid, you were always looking to make money. Like, what'd you do as a kid to make money?
There's many stories, but I think we
give
had the
any
company
meet
to. Yeah, there was a favorite one, which is the extreme one. But we had a company meetup here just last week, and I actually invited my parents to come just meet the team and like just to confirm that this company really exists, right? Because being all remote, like it's like also kind of digital and non-existent. But the story that my parents chose to explain was the one where I think I was like 4 or 5, and they took me to the library. My mom used to take us often to the library, and I was like, oh, like I look backwards. I was trying to understand what's the model here, what's going on. And I realized that my mom was paying a membership to go get us books. So what I did was I just took all the books in the house, brought them into my room, organized them, and then I asked my family to pay me a membership fee. So it's not very scalable, but the model was there.
Yeah, I see the affection for it right away. All right. And so then you go to law school. My sense is you went to law school because that's what you were supposed to do. In fact, I have this understanding that in Malta, a lot of people become lawyers. Is that right?
Yeah, it's. I think it's on the decline, but there's definitely, there's this idea that to like a profession, like a lawyer or a doctor, whatever, is the most respectable thing you can do, especially if you have the brain power for it, kind of, which is this crazy notion.
So they said, here's a smart guy. The route we have for a smart guy
doctor
is that.
Or lawyer.
I see. Well, by the way, my team put in my notes for you that you're Dr. David Darmanin. Are you a PhD?
No. So I get asked that question quite a lot. Actually, in Malta, when you graduate in law and become a lawyer, it's actually considered to be a doctorate because it's like a 6 years with a thesis, and which again is still a bullshit thing, to be honest. But in my previous startups, I realized and I had read about the psychology of persuasion, and that actually just wearing a doctor suit or leveraging these can be very powerful and actually helped to get started in the very beginning.
Got it. So this was a credibility hook in the beginning. All right. So then you saw a job ad in a newspaper, and it kind of changed your life. It was for a company that had a bunch of traffic, but they had a problem. What was their problem?
So, yeah, their problem was they had a bunch of traffic, but they didn't know how to monetize it or make the most out of it. Well, they had an idea how to monetize it, but they wanted to do a better job of that. So I remember the role name. It was optimization specialist. And I just ignored that. I was just drawn to the sentence underneath that said, we have millions of page views. Mm-hmm. And I was
usually that's the hardest thing. But then what was it about that that excited you about that challenge?
Yeah, what excited me about it was that I was sitting in our garage with my cousin trying to build what was then a shitty version of WordPress, like that idea of that. That was quite some long time ago. And I was too young, inexperienced, and I realized or at least I felt like I was winging things. And I thought, I want to get experience. This was a foreign company with a lot of traffic. And I was like, this, it just was a gut feeling that I should give this a shot.
You know, so you don't like that first idea, which was a version of WordPress, but I read some descriptions about it. It made a lot of sense. What you thought was, I'm going to make a modular way for people to create their own websites. This is pre-Squarespace. This is pre this revolution of sites that are builder sites, right? What was it about yours that wasn't a good fit, that didn't work?
It had nothing to do with the idea. I think it was more my maturity of thinking myself and my cousin in the garage can just wing it, right? And I think joining that software company gave me the ability to see the bigger picture, right? Which is how much you need to invest, like the revenue that comes in. It's more than just an idea and some code. It's the business component of it.
What didn't you do well because you weren't a mature entrepreneur yet?
I think there was more the love of doing something for the sake of doing it. So we're going to have a company name. We're going to have an office. We're going to have a business card. I see this quite often. You know what I mean? Very young, you're excited about the idea of making money, but you haven't yet really understood.
And what didn't you do while you were focusing on getting the right name and the right business card?
I wasn't thinking about market. I wasn't thinking about what resources are needed to actually execute this, right?
And who is going to buy this site? Customers. How do I find them? Where do I get the money to go hunt them down? That kind of thing. You weren't even thinking about it. Okay, so I could see why this job would be.
How are we going to acquire it at scale, right? The whole business model.
Did you actually try to get customers?
No.
No, you weren't even at that stage. You were just building.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
We were developing very slowly.
Okay. That's the first of two times that you did that pretty slowly and was an issue for you. All right. So you then went to work optimizing. What did you learn as you were optimizing all their traffic? Is this the heart of what you do now at Hotjar?
Kind of, actually. Not completely. I think we are now more the tool for the optimizers to do the research to know what to work on. But we're not in the optimization stage. And this was, I guess, the big revelation, right? Revelation for me, which was earlier on, it felt like it was more like me just throwing darts at a board. And at some point, we must hit, right? Like something interesting. And that was extremely time consuming. It was very frustrating because we were just like trying to read what other people are doing, right? Or what could we possibly do? And it took me actually quite a few years and attending some conferences to see what some more avant-garde organizations were doing, like eBay, Amazon, and whatnot.
That Wait, they you're were saying, what's the name of this role where you were supposed to optimize? The name of the company?
The company is called Uniblue.
Hitaboo.
Uniblue.
Oh, Uniboo. I did see that. Okay, so at Uniboo, in the beginning, you spent a couple of years before you went to conferences and understood all the tools that were available. What did you do in those couple of years that kept you from getting fired if you didn't know everything yet?
No, here's the thing, right? When you're starting to work on something which, let's call it, is not optimized, it's kind of relatively easy to start hitting some marks, right? You can get lucky. And especially if you follow your gut feeling and you have a relatively good gut for what is not really done.
Do you have an
example
of something that you did at Uniblue that was a gut feeling that was just a little bit better than nothing that they were doing before?
So an example would be we would have a page where a lot of traffic was coming in there and we'd say, hold on, like the link where we have this kind of ad or anchor ad, like it's not really that visible. What if we made it more visible? Or hold on, thinking about it, this text might not be that clear. What if, given the context, we make it more clear? So it's again driven by gut and what kind of is obvious, and you can get some hits with that.
You know what? I think I've seen ads for these guys. These are the people who make those protect your computer, privacy keeper type
That's
thing.
It.
They run
That's
these
it.
Ads that basically say your computer is unsafe. They look like alerts. You tap the alert, you go over to a landing page, and then you're supposed to buy the software that's supposed to fix this thing. That's their model. And that's how they
Correct.
Had all that traffic. And they were still monetizing it profitably before you.
Well, actually, no. So the story is that they were getting traffic from building content-based sites. It was libraries about stuff that can go wrong with your PC, right? This is the pre-smartphone era, so it's quite some time ago. So it was basically libraries, sites, which had content about what does this EXE do or what does this DLL file do.
Okay.
So it was actually – they were delivering quite interesting value, but then they were selling software in the back of it.
Okay. Good. And when I'm looking up their software, Privacy Keeper, et cetera, I see a lot of people say that it's malware and there are a bunch of articles about how to remove it from their computer. So they were pretty aggressive about getting people to install it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I was definitely part of that, right? So, and it's a perfect example of sometimes when you optimize too much and you don't think of your user and the customer, it's easy to get carried away. But that's the second stage, right? So first stage is
you have to get good and then you can be too good.
Exactly. So first stage was trying to hit the dart randomly at the board, trying to get there. The second stage for us was to understand, okay, there is such a thing as persuasion, as copywriting, right? And that's where we start to become more sophisticated, understanding what is the challenge and how can we be more persuasive around it. And then came the third and final stage. This is kind of the maturity, which was speak to your users and your customers. And that's where we were really shocked, right? That's where we got the type of feedback that you were just reading in those reviews, which is, hold on, this is really aggressive. What are you telling me here? This is confusing. I feel like I'm being misled. So, and that was a really big eye-opener for me.
So from there, you moved on and you ended up working for, what's the name of that company where you did conversion rate experts, right?
Conversion rate experts.
And one of the things that you took away from there was the hiring process. What was your, and you still use that to this day, what you learned from them. What was the hiring process like there that you admired so much?
Yeah, we definitely took the fundamentals from there. Because where I worked before was very different from it. It was more you meet someone in an office, right? This wasn't remote. And sometimes that's a disadvantage, right? Because you're meeting in person and you tend to rely on your personal judgment of ask a few smart questions, right? Like this person could do the job or not. Whereas what they were doing was they were really making their candidates work for the role, which was very effective. So you first answer some questions just to see, is there passion? Is there fit for the culture, the way they work together? And then they get you to do a presentation. And so the main takeaway for me was make the candidate work, right, for the opportunity to kind of get into the company. And it acts as a great way to filter, to understand, are we on the same page by asking these questions and giving some small work up front.
And so when you do that at Hotjar, what kind of work do you ask a candidate who's just responding to a help wanted ad to do?
So there's three levels of work. The first level is some basic questions, right? So it could be anything from, if it's a role in customer success, we might ask, why do customers churn? Right? It seems like a really simple question, but it kind of really hits the nail on the head of, is churn to them about just delivering good support, or is it really understanding the value proposition and delivering value, right? So it's all about mindset.
Because the easy answer is to say, because we don't do great customer support and respond to them nicely.
Yeah,
the more detailed answer that you're looking for is someone who will do a little bit of research, maybe saw that you guys did a blog post about how you created a churn team and so on and understood. And that's what you're looking for. You want the person who will put in more work than come up with what seems like the easy intuitive answer.
And is not yet at the maybe, and there's nothing wrong with giving the wrong answer, but it tends to show that you're still at the, what I call more shallow level, and your understanding of the subject matter is still very, as in it's not that sophisticated, right? You haven't spent that much time. So these questions can be very revealing. It can be very helpful.
Assumptions versus, I guess I could see three different big ways for people to answer. Assumptions, like I assume that it's because of customer service and you're testing me for that. The other is a little bit of research, which means I went and looked at your blog, other people's blog, and I understood why your people and others churn. And then the third one, maybe, which you might be looking for is experience, where someone says, what we noticed at our company was it wasn't about us customer service. It was about how fast we turned customer service over and then who we passed on to the sales saving team, whatever.
Agreed. And then there's also mindset, right?
Okay.
Which is the difference between deliver for the customer versus internal problems and things which are not working. That's not this specific example of the question, but you can pick up on this in the answers in the questions.
So David, you're looking for that. That's one way that you get people to work before they continue. What are the other two ways that you're saying that they do work?
So the second one, which is a little bit contentious, is asking them to do a video. And it's a little bit dangerous because there can be bias when you see someone in video, right? How do they present themselves? What do they look like? So we're very careful about this and we train the team. It's also this like a little bit dangerous because you're asking them to do a video and like we haven't done anything on our end. So we actually have made our own video of us answering questions just to balance it out a little bit more. But this is where we really, with the video, go for culture fit. So we ask questions like, if you could do anything on a Monday morning, what would you do? It could be a question more. So it's more human, right?
Okay.
That's that second level. And typically we're definitely looking for telltales, which I'm not going to share here, right? Because then we have to change all our video questions.
But there are certain things that you're looking for from them to get a sense of it. And it might be something like, don't just do it at your computer like you don't give a rat's ass, but maybe do it in an interesting place to show that you're...
Well, no, actually, that's a good point. We actually say don't put too much effort into the video because we don't care about that. So functional, that is our culture. So just sit down anywhere and just what we're interested is in the content,
okay,
not the effort.
I'm guessing that you like to hear them use the word bullshit a couple of times because I've seen you use that a bunch.
Yeah. I guess, the honesty piece is definitely important.
Okay. And then there's a third level of work that you want from people when you're looking
for them? Oh, yeah. So the third level, which is the one we found to be very effective, is again, this didn't come from conversion rate experts. I had read about it. I think it's called, well, kind of they do it though as well. It's this whole idea about performance recruitment, right? It's this idea that the best way to actually tell if someone's going to integrate and work well with the company is, believe it or not, give them a trial, get them to do some work, right? So what we do is anyone who makes it to the stage is given 1, 2, 3 days of work, which they can do up to 2, 3 weeks, because obviously they might have a job, and we pay for this work. And we always choose work. It's stuff that they would actually do. So it's something that we would get value out of. And I, that's a very important clarification for anyone who's thinking about copying this. There is nothing worse than to create fictitious work for someone at this stage, because that's where the whole team's like, yeah, that's cool. That's good. That's good work. That can work. Because since you don't really need that work, you lack the critical sense to kind of question the work that's being done. We did that in the beginning, and it was,
wouldn't you want the same thing to same project to be done by everyone so you can compare them? Maybe compare someone who's worked out at the job with someone who's applying, because you know how someone who worked out did on this job?
That's a good question. Not really, because what we're looking at is typically less the actual execution and the end result, but it's more the way they go about it. So did they do any research? Did they ask questions? Did they ask about the user, the customer? Okay. How was the quality of the execution, rather than maybe the final product itself?
Okay. Let me talk about my first sponsor and then get right back into, now that you learned a lot, you're going to start another business and that still didn't work out. I want to know why and what happened. The second sponsor is a company called TopTal. Do you know TopTal at all?
Yes.
You do. What do you know about TopTal? And it's okay to say negative stuff. We didn't do any coaching ahead of time.
No, I've never worked with them, but I've heard good stuff about them really being a good source for talent.
Yeah, one of the things that they do is they source talent ahead of time. They put them in their network. They get to know them. They cultivate them. They get in Slack groups with them and get in their faces and their lives for a long time. So then when someone like you or me or the person listening to us is looking to hire, they could just go to TopTal, say, here's what I'm hiring for, and here's how we work. Here are some of our quirks. Can you find someone for us? They can often find someone within a few days. You get talk to one or two people. If you like them, you could get started and hire them right away. What's one tip that you have for hiring a developer as someone who's not a developer yourself before I can, and then I'll continue the ad. What would you say, David?
Oh, so I'm very biased on this one because our experience was particular, right? So you're aware of that. I'd say have someone dedicated to doing it.
It's one person dedicated to hiring.
Well, let's put it this way. At least one person that is focused completely on doing it. Because if you have a team of developers, especially, you know, the founding team, 2, 3 developers and the founders, like if they're kind of winging it on the side, we'll try and hire more help. It's not going to work.
So you want one person who just need, when you need someone, well, how soon do you go? How many people did you have on your team before you hired someone whose job was to hire?
Well, here's the thing. We definitely waited too long. We had a 9-month beta and we were a little bit scared. Are we going to make money? Being bootstrapped, you're always waiting a little bit until there is a need as opposed to thinking ahead, right? That's always a disadvantage. So we definitely waited a little bit too long. The problem, and that's where my tip comes from, is that the moment we started to hire for it, we weren't really focused on it. So we kind of did a half-assed job. We found someone that wasn't a good fit because everyone was so busy writing code, right? So, and hiring was a secondary priority. So it took us a little bit too long to learn. We made a few mistakes and we waited way too long to have someone really, really focused on building a pipeline and hiring and doing all the things that we were talking about, the stages. And then when we did this, there was a huge difference.
But it wasn't someone whose full-time job was hiring, was it?
No, but they shifted to pretty much nearly full time, which was a big thing for us. It was like taking 1 out of 4 or 5 developers to only hire. But it was at the stage that we thought we were noticing, listen, we're growing way faster than we're coding and hiring. Wow. So we need to make things worse before they're going to get better.
All right. Well, the thing about TopTal is if anyone out there is in a situation where they need to hire fast and they actually don't have the time and bandwidth to put into the whole research process, it helps to have somebody on board to help you. And that's what TopTal is going to do. As soon as you hit the green button on the page I'm about to give you, you can get on a call with someone at TopTal or schedule one at your convenience where you'll get a consultation from them. They'll help you think through the role. They'll help you think through what you need. They'll often help you shape it. And then they'll go out and find people for you. If you're happy with them, as I said, you can talk to them. You can get started fast. If you're not, walk away. There's nothing to lose. Here's the URL where you can get, well, not just that button, but also 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks to put an emphasis on this, if at the end of your period you are not 100% satisfied, you will not be billed. So here's that URL. It's toptal.com/mixergy. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent. toptal.com/mixergy. David, I've got a screenshot here of Guest Lab. Where did the idea for this business come from?
Well, yeah, I actually wrote an interesting blog post about this because this was one of my biggest learning experiences, which is talks about passion versus market and why following your passion can be dangerous.
You didn't just say that. I read that blog post. You actually said, don't solve someone else's problem.
No, I didn't say that. No, I said, well, kind of in a way, but what I said was mainly having the passion as the starting point is a dangerous thing, right?
Okay, because factor into Guest Lab?
So with Guest Lab, it was basically myself and another person taking all the things that we knew, our passions, right? I had done parties and events, so I knew relatively kind of the brick and mortar event organizing business restaurants and whatnot. Not enough. I knew the whole conversion piece, and it was this passion driving this idea of, hold on, I know all these things. There, no one is doing this, right? So restaurants, clubs kind of are not doing any form of marketing automation. So I know this, I can create this for them, and they're going to pay me money for this, right? Sounds very easy.
And when you say marketing automation, what you mean email marketing automation?
Well, actually, it was a little bit of both.
An SMS.
Email and SMS, yeah. So again, this was quite some time ago, but it was the idea that it was a loyalty program built into kind of a guest list idea combined together.
Okay.
And then on the back of that, you could automate for having people return. It was basically the idea of increasing return customers.
Okay. And you built it over how long?
So it took us, I think, to build the core of it, like 9 months or nearly a year. The problem is that during that time, we weren't showing it to customers. So it was just us building up this dream of ours. And the problem was that by the end of it, once we actually did show it to customers, they were excited about it. And they were like, yeah, it sounds interesting. But it was very hard to sell it one by one. And we were trying to change their behavior. There wasn't really a need for it, or what I called in the article, there was no budget for it, right? So,
right. When someone says there's no budget, it means what?
Well, here's the thing, right? I stole the idea from like in enterprise, right? When you're selling to enterprise, when there's no budget, it means nothing's going to happen, right? But I think you can apply that same concept to even when you're selling something quite cheap to smaller businesses or even B2C, right? So it's this idea, if you're trying to sell something to me, and literally, I am not allocating any of my salary to the value I get out of this, or it might be even time, right, to what I'm going to get out of it, then it's very difficult to persuade me to shift my budget to what you're selling. And that's the change of behavior to me. So the example is a restaurant owner, right? Their focus is, yes, to obviously sell more and generate more business, but in the way they break down their spend, they're not thinking, I definitely need to dedicate some more money to marketing automation, right? To have people come more. It is their objective, but they're not dedicating budget to it. And
is it because they don't see it as a big enough problem? Or they don't identify it as a problem? Or they're scared of the solution? Why? Because everyone wants more customers and you created a tool to help them get more customers.
I think it's because the behavioral difference of actually acting on this versus and connecting that with the output, there's just that doubt, right? Is this actually going to happen or not? And time is the biggest like proof of this, right? That over time, they might give it a shot, but then they don't really believe in it. And again, we were testing this in Malta. It wasn't exactly the most avant-garde, you know what I mean, customer base. So a lot of the ingredients were not aligned with.
You know what? This might make me sound like a jerk, or maybe this is a problem with me doing too much research, but I found the article. It's lessons learned. What is it called? 6 lessons learned as the co-founder of a 10 million euro plus SaaS
startup.
Oh, no,
that's another article. That's my co-founder.
Right. And there you said, he said then, don't solve someone else's problem. And it the reason I'm bringing this up is it feels like what you did was you ended up solving, well, I don't know, did you end up with Hotjar solving your own problem? Is the problem, I'm just curious about problem solving, yours, someone else's. Is the issue that Guest Lab solved a problem that you don't care about? Or is it that it really didn't solve a problem that a client had?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the best way to answer it is the customer had many problems and this problem didn't make it into the budget. You know what I mean? It wasn't
It wasn't like a big issue for them. They weren't saying, how do I get my customers to come back necessarily?
It's not just, I think everyone wants their customers to come back. But there's not always a behavioral match between if I do this, it will actually translate into customers coming back, right? So they might have their own ideas about how to have customers coming back. So there's also a belief in that dedicating budget to that and their behavior and time to it will actually pay off.
Could actually do it this way. And it was a lot of time for them to invest in this new thing to get to the result that they're looking for.
Correct.
Okay.
So it was beyond education. It was also behavior. And that starts to become very difficult.
The reason I'm harping on this is because I'm fascinated by how many times in my interviews people have said, I saw a problem, a pain that someone experienced. I created a solution. That was what made this business. And I know that that's overly simplistic. And I'm looking for the nuances, the places where that's not exactly right or where it does get better if you understand a few little differences. And I think I'm getting it here.
To be completely honest, since you brought this up and again, my co-founder wrote it, I don't think I completely agree with that either. Like from where I'm coming from, everyone's influenced by their experiences. I would definitely say I personally prefer to solve my own problems because that's my strength. But let's face it, customer development, right? Identifying problems and solving for them. Many companies have succeeded in doing that and many entrepreneurs have succeeded in that way. But I guess our journey and our experience taught us that for us, that was something that we were not very good at doing.
Understanding someone else's problems.
Yeah, and solving for
them.
Who
weren't you versus now with Hotjar, essentially you're saying, I had this problem. I found these tools. Here's what we did. So let's come back then to Hotjar. This thing didn't work out 18 months. You closed it up. You invested money in it. It didn't work out. Let's talk about emotions for a second before I continue to Hotjar. How did you feel at that point? Did you feel like a failure or did you feel like someone who was a little bit closer and ready to go?
No, definitely at this stage, there was no space for emotions. Like it was like I was on the roller coaster and I was just next thing. If anything, I think the person, my co-founder on that project was more a little bit kind of disappointed because he had obviously done the code. But I remember it was a time when I had read the book The Dip by Seth Godin, right?
Yeah.
And it was just this realization of this is not it. Again, we're definitely not lining up our strengths here and we need to move on. And it was just obvious that we had to do it at that stage. Luckily, we were reading a lot and we were speaking to other founders at this stage. And this meant that this process, while it was kind of unsuccessful as a startup, the process was amazing for us because we were really learning as we were kind of failing, right?
You're smiling because there was someone walking behind you in camera.
Yep.
We're now, you guys are remote, but 12 out of how many people work at the office in Malta?
Yeah, but we had the meetup here in Malta last week, so there's quite a few people still.
Oh, they're still hanging out. Okay. Yeah. I'm looking at a Google Doc before we get to the Google Doc, Prioritizer. What was that?
Ooh, that's a good, I had forgotten about that one. So Prioritizer was this, like, the simplest idea we could come up with to build something before we actually built Hotjar. I guess we were so scared of having failed a couple of times before that we were worried, kind of, can we build something really fast, especially since I had brought two startups together. I reached out to two people that we had worked with before, Jonathan and Eric. They had their own startup and were like, hey, Mark and I, we want to join forces. Let's combine together, do something bigger. But there were some concerns around the technology we should use. Are these guys going to get along with each other? So we said, let's be super lean. And even before we are lean with the startup we're going to build, let's build something really quick and dirty together. That was Prioritizer.
Just to see if we could work together.
Yeah. And if we can build something together. Yeah.
And it was a tool that you guys actually wanted to use to help you prioritize what?
Basically prioritize what to do next. So the idea was that you put in ideas and then everyone can rate them based on effort and expected value, and then it automatically plots them out in a graph.
Okay. All right. So you liked working with them. It seems like that project is still on GitHub, right? Is that yours?
I'm not sure, actually. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I need to check about that. We never used it, though.
Jeffrey Hansen. Is that the guy who?
No.
It's okay. Not someone else has got it. Okay. So then you decided we're going to figure out what to create. I'm looking at a Google Doc. You guys are so good about keeping track of your work. Even this freaking Google Doc is organized beautifully. It's an internal doc that basically helped you figure out what to create. Was heat maps the first thing to do for Hotjar?
Yeah, you asked a very interesting question, because heat maps is something that Hotjar is very famous for, and it's one of the things a lot of people come for. And we were torn about this, because getting value out of heat maps is not that easy. And it's kind of, if we had to do a functionality by value list, it wouldn't be highest on the list, right? Because there is a little bit of an eye candy to it. But we knew we had to build it because we knew there was a lot of demand and people get excited about it. So yeah, it was definitely the first thing we wanted to build, also because the technology behind plotting clicks and movement onto a page is the basis of other functionality that we were doing.
And a heat map, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is just the same page that you're looking at or the web page that you're trying to analyze with a heat map on it that shows you where people move their mouse most, right?
There's also clicked some, most. Yeah.
And what else? Attention?
And where your mouse moved as well. So, yeah. And scrolling.
So you understood that you needed to understand your customer better and to be better positioned this time for success. So what did you do to do that before you even started coding, before you even decided that heat maps was the first thing to do? Hey, how'd you set yourself up for success now with Hotjar?
And I guess coming back to the solve for your own problems thing, this is where we were lucky, right? So I had worked for 2 years as a consultant, working with many large organizations and hearing their pains. And before that, I had worked in-house in a software company where we were using tools. And before that, I was the student, the enthusiast who couldn't use tools because they were horrible and expensive. So I was kind of these segments that we were building for myself, which made it very, very easy for us to kind of know what we were building. So I was kind of the internal customer as a product owner and CEO of a 5-person team saying, here's what we should build and here's how we should do it. So that was a huge advantage.
Because you saw something that you needed, or because you understood that all your clients needed this?
It was both. It was both. It was this moment of realization when I needed it, and I didn't realize how many more people had the same itch.
Mm-hmm. And you needed it for the client work that you were doing on the side, which was funding the software that you were trying to figure out what
correct.
It should be.
Correct. And even before that, I needed it internally, but it was
but
not
David,
good enough.
There are tools that did this. Google Analytics includes it. There was Crazy Egg, which focused on this stuff. There was Clicktail, which told a little bit more data. Why didn't those platforms work? And Crazy Egg was super cheap. Google Analytics is free.
Yeah, the difference was that – so Google Analytics is pure numbers, right? So it's not really visualizing the experience that much.
They do some visuals, don't they? They do that.
Yeah, but the problem is it's more based on page movement as opposed to behavior. So that's very different. So Google Analytics will visualize how many people went from this page to this page through this link, but it won't show you how many people actually move their mouse in this region of the page.
Okay.
That's one. More importantly, you can't visualize and empathize with, oh my God, people are getting stuck here. And I'd say the biggest value of what we did with Hotjar when we launched was more bringing these kind of elements all together. So it's asking questions, it's visualizing, it's all these elements together, which previously sat separately or in different tools. And they were really expensive separately, and they didn't play well together. So the biggest advantage here was you have one script you put on your site, and you can just do all the research you need to do with one interface. That was the big advantage.
And what's the difficulty of having two different tools that don't talk to each other? Do you have an example of that?
Well, it's mainly, obviously, when you're an agency and working with multiple clients, it can be very like intensive for both the client and the customer when you're saying, okay, let's get started. So we need 5 tools. Here's the 5 scripts. You need 5 accounts. Sign up for them all. When you're done, let me know so I can log into all of them, send you the report. So with agencies, that was a big hit, right? And then what happened was that the agencies started spreading the word and more in-house teams were like, oh, obviously the pain was less. But then we also did some other things in the way we did our pricing, which was a little bit innovative. And that struck a chord also with the in-house teams as well.
I'm going to write a note here about pricing, all-in-one, and agencies. And I want to come back to all three of those. I'll quickly talk about my second sponsor. It's a company called Hostgator. I think it was Indie Hackers who in an interview with you asked you, how do you even hire developers when you're not a developer? How do you even know what to get coded up or something like that? And I believe your answer was, it's not that hard, dude. You don't have to understand the whole thing. What you have to do is just go get a website, just start playing with the HTML. Don't be afraid to break it and then redo it. Am I right?
Yep.
And that's what you did in the beginning. You were just a guy studying law who decided you were going to do this.
Yep, exactly.
So, guys, if you're out there and you want to do that, I really urge you to go check out Hostgator. It's super cheap. It really is super easy to install anything you want on there, especially if it's one of those one-click installs of software like WordPress. Click WordPress, install it, play with it, break it, and then you know what? Just start it up again. If you want, you could get the unlimited domain package where you can install another domain, another domain, another domain, and break them all. There's no danger in it. All you have to do is go to hostgator.com/mixergy. When you do, you're going to get unmetered disk space, unmetered bandwidth, unlimited email addresses, and you're going to get 45-day money-back guarantee if you're not happy with it. It's super easy. We did it, and frankly, we started getting too much traffic, so then we scaled it up, and we called them up, and we said, what else do you have? And we got the next level up, and then we said, what else do you have? And we got the next level up, and we found that as the business grows, they could help grow with you, and it's always much cheaper than the competition from what we've seen. Go to hostgator.com/mixergy. David, let's talk about agencies. Did you know at first that you were going to go after agencies? Not necessarily, right?
No. Actually, that's definitely, we were learning a lot as we were going along. The story around that was that we opened up this beta program, right? So it was this whole idea of, okay, let's not spend a year building this like we did before and then no one wants it, right? So instead we were like, okay, let's quickly build the technology, which we know we can actually promise something, actually deliver. And then create a landing page, which is a homepage of Hojar.com, which is basically, here's what we're going to build. If you're interested in this, sign up, right? And at that stage, we started to see a lot of interest, a lot of people coming in. That was the point.
But you did more than that. And I know you're going to get to that. So it's not like you're hiding it. But I've got an email here from Jeremy Shoemaker from 2014 saying, I recently came into contact with Dr. David Garmanin, a conversion and behavioral expert. Long story short, and then he goes into a bit of a longer story, but he's basically saying all these tools all in one. He's making them available. If you want to go hit this URL and you'll get early access to it. And my sense is you paid him to have him send that email to his audience. No?
Well, actually, there were some instances where we did pay, yes. But I think most people were doing this because we created basically was like a waiting list, right? So here we're going back to the whole guest lab thing, right? So we learned from that startup a lot by doing experimenting with the few customers we had about what made people act, right? What made people do stuff for their points in their loyalty program. And we found there were two things that people loved to do, okay, right? Well, actually, let's take it from another angle. There are two types of people that will do something for something, right? There are the competitive types. Those are the ones where you say, if like the number one position, you get the mega prize, right? These are the guys that just go nuts about that and they'll do
anything
to get
there. Because they need to be number one.
Exactly. And then there are the participators, the ones that would like to be involved, but they want a guaranteed outcome. So those are the guys that like would love to hear, do this thing 5 times and you get this in return. So we had learned this. So we knew, okay, so if we're doing an early access program, the moment you put in your email because you want Hotjar, then we show a page which says, hey, you're number 679 in the queue, but if you refer this to friends, you're going to move up the list. And by the way, if you're the top 10, you get a lifetime Hotjar account, right? Free forever, which a lot of people went nuts for.
Which is shocking, yes.
Yeah. Which, when you think about it, though, it's a no-brainer, right? Like, what does that cost?
Yeah,
us?
I know. And still, I do the same thought process, and I still think, oh, lifetime. Yeah, that's still incredible.
Yeah,
as a user,
exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you just need to think as the user. And then what we did was, I think it was like the top 200 positions, they get a Hotjar T-shirt. Top 20, there was something else. We just did levers, and this just like it went nuts. So it really was on fire.
So some people got something guaranteed. Some people got something only if they made it to the top. So what I'm hearing you say is you bought a few email ads from companies like Product Hunt, I think it was, from Betalist. They then sent people to your site, and you turned it viral by having this point system that enabled people to...
Well, it was actually a little bit the other way around. So we started this. We started sending it to friends, and we noticed that roughly for every... 5 people that signed up, we'd get 2 or 3 that signed up virally on the back of that, right? So we said, hold on, if this, and we're every week we're hitting 1,000, 3,000, 4,000. We're like, hold on, if this is working so well, what if we actually spent some money on this? This is something we had done a lot. So this is the point where, yeah, Product Hunt wasn't paid. So we got lucky there. We got featured. But then we did definitely buy some emails. And the way we did that was we would go, so we'd say, okay, we know we're building this for web designers and marketers. So we said, what are the most popular sites out there that we can give some money to? And they'll send an email to their list saying, hey, everyone, we'd like to introduce you to Hotjar. And we found a few lists and it was incredibly effective. Email is most definitely not dead.
No, it's really, it's effective. It's less effective than it used to be. But to be able to get a company to even let you pay to reach their audience via email is tough. But that is effective. Where was that? Oh, I had a question teed up here on my screen. Oh, somewhere on here, I have your website as it used to appear in 2014. The reason I wanted to bring it up, and I just lost the tab, is... It was like 6 different things that you were offering all at once. I'm wondering why you decided to start with so many different tools instead of saying, we're going to be just this one, and then we'll add another to the next month, and so on.
Yeah, I'd say for us, it was our positioning, right? It was, as I said before, the one script, one interface. That was really what we were offering. It was crazy in hindsight because we said tried to do too much. But that was mainly what we wanted to achieve. And that's why we did the whole self-funding and did the beta, because we knew we needed to actually build all of that right together.
Yeah, look at this. This is an early version of your site. There's actually an image up that says, the old way, you need Ethnio, Quicktail, Qualaroo, Crazy Egg, SnapEngage, SurveyMonkey. The new way is you just need us, and we'll do all of it for you. You even did like the stuff that Intercom does, proactive chat on people's websites. All right. You started to get people to come in. You told our producer, I finally knew I was onto something, because with the previous company, I had to keep chasing people down, always chasing, hoping someone would use. Here, it was different. People just came. They would just sign up. People I didn't know would end up registering. And then you had to start going into paid. And the paid seems to have happened around the time you ended the beta. Am I right?
Yeah, a couple of months before. So towards the end, yeah.
And so how do you go from offering this thing for free to starting to charge?
That was the scariest part. And this was, I'll never forget. I remember we had seen someone, another company, I forgot the name, but they had done a beta as well, but they had done it paid. So it was like this whole idea of, yeah, we're going to offer this for $29, but you pay before. And we're like, shit, why didn't we think of that? Because that we would have felt much better investing more and doing the beta longer if we knew we had credit cards on file, which means there is intent to pay afterwards. So we were just really scared.
Oh, if you could have done it, the better way is to say, we're doing beta. You'll get it for free. But once it gets out of beta, we'll switch you to paid. Here's what it's going to cost, and we'll give you notice. And the reason you wanted that is to get some more intent from people, to know exactly that they were really interested, and to make it easier to transition, and also to not have any surprises.
Because this is the point we have... four people being paid, right, and I'm not one of them, we're burning cash, we have users in Hodra using it, but we're not sure, are they using it because it's just free, or are they using it because they really want to keep on using it? So this was very scary. So we put a lot of thought into how we're going to transition out of this. So we started communicating the end of beta date very early so that there would be no surprises. When we got to it, we decided to actually extend, like, this is the date, but after that date, you're actually going to get even another month for free, just to sweeten kind of the message. And then we said, if you continue using Hotjar as you are today, then you have to pay. But then we realized from the surveys we were doing, so eating our own dog food, right, asking our users what they thought, we discovered that we had a lot of ambassadors, people that were loved Hotjar, but they could never pay. They were students or startups, enthusiasts. And we're like, hold on, do we really want to kind of out, essentially? And that's the point where we started to say, what if we created a slightly inferior version of what we're asking people to pay for, and that's free? So that would allow us to spread the word even faster.
So you know what I noticed was, for some reason our audio and video are a little out of sync right now, but that's fine because I can still hear you. The thing that I noticed is that other people who do that will brand the sites of the people who have it free. So if you're using, what's an example of this? Let's say Hello Bar. If you're not paying for Hello Bar, there's a branding for Hello Bar on your site. Same thing for sumo.com and so on. I don't think you guys do that.
We do it with our feedback widgets, yeah.
Just the feedback widgets, but not the heat maps, not...
Correct. Because that would be a little bit intrusive, right? Because where are we going to show it? Ideally, like with the Hello Bar and the widgets, like you have somewhere where to show it, so
and it's in context. I don't know, because Mixpanel does it. They just put it on whatever page that they're analyzing.
I believe that's actually opt-in. So with Mixpanel, you can add the badge and then you get like a bump up in your freemium, free tier.
All right. So then what's in it for you for just servicing all these people who are free? Is it knowledge of user information?
Way we see it, so we don't leverage the data in any way. So to us, we see it, it's an acquisition model, right? So those people actually bring other people in through either the widget, through word of mouth. So that's the way we see it. We see it as brand building, and it works very well for us. And luckily, the costs of managing and hosting those accounts are relatively low. So it's actually a very good acquisition model.
Okay. So I don't notice that you did it, but all the logos on all the free widgets are links back to your site, which then mean that you're getting customers that way.
Correct.
Okay. So how big a share of your new customers come that way?
Well, actually not a lot. But attribution in these things is very difficult, we found. When we survey and speak to our customers, we don't have the most sophisticated attribution model set up, let's put it that way. But we know when speaking to customers that there is a lot of word of mouth involved, which is obviously very difficult to measure.
Okay. All right. You told our producer we're not really good at content marketing. So what we focused on is what we are good at, which is advertising. How did you get into advertising? And by the way, I disagree with you. I think you guys are phenomenal at content marketing, and we'll talk about that. But for advertising, what worked for you in the beginning, and how did you scale it up?
So in my previous experience, we talked about that software company. They were heavily advertising. They were reliant very heavily on advertising. So I was brought in to optimize a lot of these campaigns, and we learned a lot from that stage of reading a lot about copywriting and everything. We knew how to do performance advertising, like manage bids and all that stuff. So we came with nearly a decade of experience. So that's what I mean. It was like really easy to get it going that way. So we definitely took the easy route.
So what worked for you in the beginning when you were starting? And you know what? Hang on, let me hang up and I'll call you right back and we'll find out what worked for you. Okay, so with all that advertising experience, what did you know that you were able to implement when you were just getting started?
Yeah, so I guess it taught us what type of message, like let's take a step back. The biggest mistake most people do is that when they think advertising, they think brand. And Brand is something you do at a much later stage, right? When you've got something new and you want to introduce audiences to it, the last thing you want to go with is Hotjar, right? Like that's right. Not where you start. Start with the problem, solution. That's the easiest way to start engaging people coming in. Then later you do brand. So we knew that. And that's a big advantage. So we tested a lot of different angles of how we can introduce the product to these audiences. And we found the one that really worked for us, which was basically the idea of see how your visitors are really using your site. That was the angle which really connected.
So you were testing the different language on your landing pages to see which one got people to actually register to use it?
Actually, it was much less sophisticated than that. We were just testing it. When you do advertising at this level, you just start by testing it on the ad level. So we literally were running ads in Facebook and testing different ways of describing it and just found the one that got the biggest click-through rate and that resonated, and then that just worked everywhere. So
okay, and then you were saying what was the next level for advertising for you as you guys were scaling it up?
And then from there, we started to move towards more intent-based advertising. So, right, so to start with, it was more Facebook. We know you're a web designer. We know you're a marketer. We roughly probably understand the problem. Then we start doing more sophisticated. So, and this is important because this process allowed us to understand how much are we willing to spend in order to acquire a user, right? So it's the process of understanding if I spend so much, I'm going to get so many users, so many of them become a customer. This is how much money I can make from them over time, which then allows you to do more expensive, sophisticated stuff like bidding on Google search ads. And that's where it becomes more interesting because then you're starting to bid on someone searching for heat map. But now you know from Facebook what are the messages that resonate, so you can connect that to the heat map. So it starts to become more interesting.
Okay. All right. And then content marketing, you said you're not good at. Why do you think you're not good at content marketing?
So here's what we mean by we're not good at content marketing. We didn't have the patience early on to be writing stuff and putting it out there and waiting it for you know what I mean?
Got it. Yes.
And I'm much, much better at like jumping on a video and having this conversation than sitting down and spending a lot of time writing.
Me too.
But since then, we've hired some amazing people that are starting to change that around for us. So,
yeah, your writing it's not just good, but your posts have a lot of good design in them. Like the one that I mentioned earlier by Mark, your co-founder at the company. He doesn't just say, here are my 6 tips. There's an image for each one clearly saying what the tip is that looks really nice. Each section is accompanied by good graphics. It's just really well done. But it takes longer to put together and it takes longer for it to deliver results, and that's why you didn't do it. You guys, even when you did the reason I know that everyone met up in Malta is you guys did a great blog post about how you organize your team meeting. And we organize team meetings on a regular basis, and I want to know what do you guys do? How do we learn more about it? All right. Why don't we see, where's that? Final thing. Seasonality is a big issue for you guys.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, more than a big issue, what we've found is that, unsurprisingly, it's more retention that is a problem, right? So the way Hotjar is built and the way it works, many customers come to us with a project in mind.
Right.
So they come to us like, I need research so that I can do this project well at the end of the project.
And the project is something like, I need to improve my conversion rate on this form page or on this landing page?
Correct.
Okay, so they come to you and then?
And then what might happen is we sometimes get feedback, like when we ask people, if you're no longer using Hotjar, what's the reason, right? And they say, no, we love Hotjar, but like, we've got the research. Now we're going to go redesign the whole site. It's going to take us a few months, and then we'll be back after that, right? So where we don't see that problem is in more lean companies that think more like we do in terms of you're always
constant
working.
Iteration.
You're always.
So then, how do you solve that, or do you just accept it?
No. You can in SaaS, you can never accept that, right? And so what we're working on is first off, how do we help? Give a helping hand to better understand how to do this more continuously. Second, how do we inspire in terms of always having a project going on? And three, how do we take the product more to a space where it's something you more plug your business into and you're always getting insights and valuable stuff versus just plugging in and out when you're doing that project?
And you don't have an answer for that yet that you're ready to share?
Well, let's just say that we've got hypotheses that we're building around, but we don't know the answers yet, no.
I'll close it out with two questions. The first is, you're in Malta, but I've interviewed people who go to Malta for tax benefits. As I understand it, you don't get that because you're from Malta. You're a citizen. Yeah.
So we have this really interesting rule, which is if you're a foreigner, you come here with your money and build a business and sell abroad, then you get some really nice tax cuts.
Only if you're a foreigner who comes in and sells abroad?
Only if you're a foreigner.
Okay.
So the island is tiny. There's this big focus on bringing more people from abroad to invest here. So hopefully someday we'll persuade the country to also think about the local entrepreneurs and give them the same treatment.
But if you're there, you don't get that.
No.
Wow. We pay
35% corporate tax.
Wow. And then after that, you have to pay personal taxes.
Of course. Then it's just corporate tax, yeah.
All right. And then is it inappropriate for me to ask you about your bracelet? It's come up in the video a few times, and I've been wondering about it. You said no.
Sure.
Yeah, what is that? The one, the backside of that.
The backside of this. This one?
Yeah.
So this is actually a gift from my wife. And we love to travel a lot, less so with our young ones. But she basically bought me this because they are the coordinates of, I think it was in Greece. It was one of the best holidays we had. We had an amazing time. So she gave this to me to remember that. So
cool. Looks good. All right. Thanks so much for doing this interview. The website for anyone who wants to go check it out is Hotjar. What I always appreciated about your site is that it's easy to spell and somehow easy to remember. I don't even know what Hotjar has to do with insights into a website, but it always stuck out for me when I saw it on Hacker News. So hotjar.com for anyone who's listening. And I want to thank my two sponsors. The first will host your website, right? Do what David did. Just get started. Go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. And if you hate your hosting company, switch over to them. They'll make it easy. They'll make the migration a snap. And second, if you need a developer, go check out toptal.com/Mixergy. And finally, somebody who has an Echo or Google Home or whatever the Apple speaker is, please give it a shot. Yell at it and say, play Mixergy podcast. Yell whatever the open phrase is and then say, play Mixergy podcast. Let me know what you think of it. I think that's going to be a great way for us to reach people while they're doing the dishes, while they're walking around the house, while they're waking up. Right?
Yeah.
David, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. Absolute pleasure and honor.
Right on. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.